The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November-December 2025 issue. We begin with our feature story. Huh? Hearing connections. Noise threatens our sense of sound, but that's not all. It also threatens our sense of our surroundings and our ties to the people and world around us. Sound has power. The audiologist Deanna Minky holds a tuning fork in one hand and a ping pong ball on a string in the other. Her demonstration is well rehearsed. A professor at the University of Northern Colorado, Minky is also the co-director of Dangerous Decibels, a nationwide initiative encouraging kids to safeguard their hearing. Minky strikes the tuning fork against a desk and raises it to the ping pong ball, which swings away, falls back, and springs away again, dancing spastically until the fork's hum fades. When she makes her declaration, her voice lingers on the word power, as if casting a spell. Sounds are essentially waves of energy that trigger cascades of molecular collisions. These waves can certainly be powerful, damaging our inner ears and causing hearing loss. This alone makes exposure to noise a large public health problem. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 40 million American adults have noise-induced hearing loss, and by 2060, the number could exceed 73 million. Meanwhile, research increasingly suggests that noise starts to erode hearing well before standard screenings detect any deficit. Noise harms more than just our hearing, however. Adults with hearing loss are at an increased risk of social isolation, depression, and dementia. The damage is so profound that it can affect what matters most, our connections with others and with the world itself. Any exploration of noise must begin with a sound hitting your ear. A pulse of energy passes through the air until it vibrates your eardrum, the membrane at the boundary to your middle ear. There, three tiny bones, the ossicles, transfer that energy to a smaller membrane at the entrance to your inner ear and another bone, the cochlea. Inside your cochlea, fluid wavelets triggered by the vibrations jostle thousands of hair cells, which line the length of the bone and are named for the tufts of hair-like stereocilia protruding from their tips. A hair cell bent by acoustic energy releases the chemical neurotransmitter glutamate into neural connections at its base. These synaptic ribbons then fire off electrical impulses to the auditory nerve, which ferries the acoustic signals to the brain, allowing you to hear. This is where loudness, measured in decibels, can start to cause trouble. Louder sounds carry more acoustic energy and trigger a larger release of glutamate. Too much high decibel excitement causes hair cells to overfill their synaptic ribbons with glutamate, to the point where they swell and pop, a gristly process known as excitotoxicity. Eventually, the battering caused by noise will kill off entire hair cells, but the first to go are these synaptic connections to the auditory nerve, disrupting the flow of neural messages between ear and brain. How much loudness is too loud is a matter of ongoing debate. The National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, suggests a limit of 85 decibels, which is as loud as heavy traffic over an 8-hour workday. But that doesn't mean that 85 decibels is safe. It's simply the threshold that a 50-year-old study links with a 15% rise in the risk of hearing loss for workers. The Environmental Protection Agency, meanwhile, recommends that people cap their exposure at 70 decibels, or about as loud as a dishwasher, over the course of 24 hours. Most of us have no idea how close we are to these decibel danger zones because almost all the loudness in our lives goes unmeasured. The best data comes from workplaces, and even that's limited. In the United States, NIOSH has traditionally focused on a handful of industries in which the most noise hits cars, in which the most noise hits the most ears, namely manufacturing, construction, and mining. There, workers' rates of hearing loss hover between 20 and 25%. But in the mid-2010s, the agency launched a broad hunt for occupational hearing loss and found it everywhere, including among 19% of healthcare workers and 17% of service workers. Even less is known about our exposure to non-occupational noise. Spot checks of New York City's subway platforms have found that trains screeching into stations emit up to 111 decibels. In 2016, Boston researchers visited 17 local spin classes and found an average of 100 decibels there, a loudness NIOSH recommends we endure for no more than 15 minutes without ear protection, and a peak of 116 decibels, which can damage hearing in seconds. A 2021 analysis of 10 Nashville music venues found that they averaged 112 decibels and exceeded 101 decibels 90% of the time. Among the fallout from this growing din are rising rates of hearing loss. A 2016 study found, for instance, that between 6 and 24% of American adults show signs of hearing loss in one or both ears, specifically from their exposure to noise. Some loudness is unavoidable, some is forced upon us, and some we choose, but it all adds up. Your ears don't care if the decibels come from your job, your local bar, or your power tools. They don't care whether the music blasting from your earbuds is rock, country, or hip-hop. If the sound is loud enough, it will cause damage, and a tiny piece of your sonic world will be lost. While the numbers from NIOSH and other agencies are alarming enough, there's reason to believe that hearing loss is even more widespread, and its harms even more extreme than previously understood. Audiograms have long been the standard for diagnosing hearing loss. They work by pinging a person's ears with beeps of increasing loudness. The beeps start soft and grow louder until the listener detects them. The adult threshold for normal hearing is 25 decibels, and hearing loss is defined as a threshold shift when the tone must be turned up to 30 decibels or more to be heard. An audiogram is a very simple task, explains Charles Lieberman, a senior scientist at Massachusetts Eye and Ear in Boston. Is there a stimulus there or not? It doesn't require discrimination and understanding. As it is, most people don't complain to audiologists about missing sounds at a particular decibel level. They're instead distressed by struggles to converse with friends and family in crowded spaces. They miss out on stories and can no longer engage in banter. They're embarrassed by their need to constantly ask others to repeat themselves. When people can no longer follow conversations, they start withdrawing from social activities and isolate themselves, a risk factor for dementia. A study from 2011 found more than 600 adults over 12 years and found that mild hearing loss doubled their chance of developing dementia, while severe hearing loss quadrupled it. Meanwhile, a 2020 meta-analysis found that hearing loss raised the risk of depression by nearly 50%. Nevertheless, up to 1 in 5 people who report difficulty with hearing in noisy environments have unblemished audiograms. In fact, Lieberman has found that noise can cause profound inner ear damage long before standard screenings find anything amiss. The evidence of this hidden hearing loss can be discovered in the deceased, whose inner ears can be examined closely. Studying the ears of around 24 dead, none of whom had any history of diagnosed hearing loss, Lieberman and colleagues have found that the auditory nerve fibers of people with ostensibly healthy ears disappear over time, a pattern that's caused by a combination of age and noise. By age 60, no ear had less than a 30% decrease in nerve fibers, and the majority had lost double that amount. Even that much damage can easily be missed by an audiogram, Lieberman stresses. The ear retains enough nerve connections to successfully detect a beep, but is overwhelmed by anything more complicated, experiencing the sonic equivalent of a pixelated image. This loss of precision matters because hearing isn't always easy. Just to chat with a friend in a busy coffee shop, our brains must separate all the sounds buzzing around us, distinguishing one voice from the others. In that way, it's the hearing that connects us to others that is most vulnerable to noise, which causes harm that begins before anything surfaces on an audiogram and extends well beyond anything it can measure. Since noise-induced hearing loss is irreversible, the only effective antidote is prevention. Lieberman doesn't know how many hair cells and synapses we could save if we took better care of our ears, but he always keeps some earplugs handy for using the snowblower, mowing the lawn, or working with power tools. They're so cheap and easy, he says. It would be crazy not to use them. Yet judging by NIOSH numbers alone, protecting our ears remains a hard sell, despite decades of noise guidelines and awareness campaigns. The majority of America's noise-exposed workers don't wear hearing protection, and even in the noisiest industries, about a third of workers still say no thanks. Outside of work, the idea of hearing protection rarely registers. A nationwide study in 2018 revealed that a mere 8% of Americans made an effort to safeguard their ears at loud concerts or sporting events. We protect what we value, says Minky, and I don't think people value their hearing consciously. She and other audiologists suggest that this apathy is driven by two main factors. First, many people falsely assume that hearing loss is simply part of growing old, like graying hair and wrinkles. In truth, hearing acuity does degrade naturally with age, but studies show that a lot of age-related loss is likely due to a persistent auditory assault over the years, rather than the years themselves. Second, hearing loss is usually incremental. Hearing erodes gradually, with a slow decay disguising the true extent of what we lose. As a conversation starter, Minky routinely asks people a deceptively simple question. What's your favorite sound? Ask somebody about their favorite color and the answer will be automatic. But when Minky asks patients or audiences at her talks on noise to volunteer their favorite sounds, people hesitate as if they've never considered the idea. These inquiries started a couple of decades ago when Minky was trying to cajole a patient to wear the hearing protection his company provided. He was a middle-aged factory worker who figured that noise was just part of his job and not something to worry or complain about. Wearing hearing protection at the factory was voluntary, but annual screenings for hearing were mandatory. Every year, Minky would tell the patient that his hearing was deteriorating, and every year he would decline to do more to protect his ears. Then, one time she asked him if he had a favorite sound. The patient loved to fish and said his favorite noise was the high-pitched kiss of a trout taking the fly at the end of his line. I said, "You will lose that sound. It won't be a part of your life if you don't protect your ears," Minky recalls. From then on, the man wore hearing protection without fail. Over the years, Minky has amassed some 3,300 favorite sounds. A whopping 70% of kids pick animal sounds. Human sounds are also popular, as are nature's elemental tones, from crashing waves to rustling trees. About 2% of people prefer silence, but they rarely mean the absence of sound. They say, "Silence is when I'm skiing, and it's the end of the day, and everybody's already down the mountain, and I stop and listen. Or, when I'm home, my roommates are gone, the TV's off, and everything is still," Minky explains. It's more about their quiet time, somewhere removed from everyday life. Minky's experience illustrates that getting people to care about their hearing will take more than scary statistics and stricter regulations. Instead, it will require a deeper appreciation of everything we are protecting. Hearing, like our other senses, connects us to our world, and severing those connections cuts deep. Simply put, ear protection is pro-sound. Our intention is never to tell people to stop doing noisy things, Minky says. We want to equip them with the strategies to make healthy choices. Sometimes that means using earplugs. Sometimes it's turning down the volume. Other times it's knowing when to walk away. Minky preaches flexibility. Some protection is better than no protection. Sooner is better than later, and it's never too late. Mating mistakes. Male frogs often mistake other species, objects, and even lifeless frogs for mates, a mix-up known as misdirected amplexus. A fish, a coconut, a ruler, a turtle, a mango, a gecko, and even a dead frog. These are just some of the odd things that frogs have been recorded trying to have sex with. Frog sex in most species involves the male gripping onto the female from behind for long periods of time, from hours to days, until they've succeeded in fertilizing their eggs. But mating can be very competitive for these amphibians, causing some males to try to copulate with things that can't actually give them offspring. Scientists have observed this phenomenon, called misdirected amplexus, in frogs for over a century, and are continuing to dig into its prevalence, its origin, and its connection to the climate. While the work is still far from finished, their findings so far show that the phenomenon is potentially more common and more ancient than previously thought, suggesting that frogs often make mistakes and have been making them for millions of years. In the century between 1920 and 2020, scientists recorded at least 378 cases of misdirected amplexus, according to a 2022 paper published in Ecology. Although such cases are mostly accidental flukes, the behavior seems widely distributed. It's present in many branches of the frog tree of life, with records coming from 156 species, 52 countries, and 6 continents. It's actually very widespread in every scale that you look into, says study author Felipe Serrano, an ecologist at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. You can find it in forests, savannas, temperate regions, and tropical regions. In most cases, 282 to be precise, male frogs were attempting to mate with frogs from other incompatible species with whom they were not able to reproduce. Fair mistake. But the records show that in 46 instances, the misdirected amplexus was carried out on dead frogs. Meanwhile, there were 50 recorded observations in which it was performed on other animals or objects. The primary theory experts use to justify this behavior is simple, as a strategy to overcome competition. For many frogs, mating only occurs during specific times of the year, and female frogs are often outnumbered by their male counterparts. So the behavior is born out of necessity. Better to be overzealous than to miss out on reproduction. Grasp, ask questions later, Serrano says. There's a positive outcome of this behavior as a whole, and sometimes the act of misdirected amplexus can actually yield offspring, as there have been cases of dead female frogs carrying eggs that could still be successfully fertilized. Still, misdirected amplexus isn't always beneficial for frog reproduction. That's because every second spent on a mate that isn't going to bear offspring because, for example, she happens to be a rock, is time wasted, meaning that a male's precious chance at reproduction could have been squandered. For the individual who spent 2 hours attempting to mate with a rock, there's no upside whatsoever. But as a whole, if you look at populations, the ability to grab the first thing that you see is actually a very good trait to have, says Serrano, who explains that evolution favors individuals that have honed their ability to find their mates quickly. Building off records like those in the 2022 study, a team of researchers looked into the emergence of this behavior, using probability to estimate when it first evolved. The team, led by François Brichot, a biologist from the French National Center for Scientific Research, used data from 280 cases of misdirected amplexus, tracing the frog's family trees and evolutionary histories. It's a statistical process, Brichot says. Knowing the current characters of this extant species, we can go back in time and calculate the probability that these characters occurred earlier. According to their calculations, published in the Biological Journal of Linnaean Society in 2023, there's more than a 97% chance that this behavior dates back to antiquity. In other words, even the first ancestors of the modern frog, who lived 220 million years ago, were likely already trying to mate with everything in sight. It's a bit fuzzy. We don't know really when such behavior first occurred, Brichot says. But what we found is that the probability that these behaviors were occurring very early, before the diversification of this group, is very likely. Its ancient origins aside, the number of times that misdirected amplexus has been recorded in frogs in the past 100 years seems to have grown exponentially over time, especially since the start of the 21st century. This could be a consequence of the fact that researchers have only started paying more attention to this phenomenon recently. In other words, as of now, there isn't enough information to know whether there's an increase in mating mistakes or merely an increase in the reports of them. Still, both Brichot and Serrano suspect that increased human interference with nature and the fragmentation of natural habitats and biodiversity could play a role in frogs getting extra frisky. Not only that, frogs are much more likely to come across objects like plastic cups as humans continue to invade their turf. In short, the range of things they can accidentally grasp is a lot more than what they are used to be 100 or 200 years ago, says Serrano, who is currently working to pinpoint more details about misdirected amplexus and whether rising global temperatures could play a role. So get used to the idea of a frog grasping onto a shoe or a tennis ball. You might just see it yourself one day. Left in the dust. Ancient artworks have adorned Chile's Atacama Desert for thousands of years, but the stories they tell are being erased, all while archaeologists implore authorities to take action. On the arid and seemingly sterile surface of the Atacama Desert lies an invaluable treasure of history and culture, upwards of 5,000 ancient artworks called geoglyphs, arranged into various designs made of sand and stone. Stretched on the slopes of the hills, these works were once silent witnesses to the caravan routes of pre-Columbian peoples. Gonzalo Pimentel, archaeologist and president of the Atacama Desert Foundation, describes them as accurate maps leading to the Pacific Ocean and as records of memories, habits, and customs. Depicting artwork that resembles humans, llamas, birds, and enigmatic geometric shapes, these colossal designs have reflected the Andean worldview for over 3,000 years. However, this rare heritage, which has yet to be fully explored, is under constant threat. Among the main culprits are cross-country motorists, deforming the ancient artwork as they race across the desert with cars and motorcycles, and mining companies, disrupting the sands in pursuit of copper and lithium. The marks of passing vehicles alter the geoglyphs' designs, rendering them unrecognizable and, in some cases, irreparable. Pimentel believes that this is the case with the geoglyphs at Alto Barranco, which are over 1,000 years old and located south of the city of Iquique in the Tarapacá region, about 1,000 miles from Santiago, Chile. Vehicle tracks have disfigured the geometric designs of these sites, some of which span up to 100 feet, or 30 meters. The lines from the motorcycles look very whitish. That means they've already dug deep into the hill, Pimentel explains. Researchers have noted that the damage has been progressive since the 1980s. Pre-Columbian cultures originally created the Alto Barranco geoglyphs by removing the dark surface sediments from the hills, resulting in whitened designs that were visible from a distance. Now, having unsettled the sandy surface and created similarly white tracks, vehicles have removed sediments as well, tracing new designs that muddle the appearances of the old. It's a tragedy to see the state of those geoglyphs. It's almost surreal that these expressions, which are nearly unique in the world, are not protected, says Marcela Sepulveda, president of the Chilean Archaeology Society. Though the Atacama Desert geoglyphs fall under the authority of the Chilean government, the National Monuments Law that is meant to protect them is loosely enforced. Those who interfere with the art are rarely penalized with prison time or fines. Archaeologists, anthropologists, and other researchers believe the geoglyphs need to receive more attention from the public and authorities for the sanctions against those who damage the integrity of these sites to be effectively enforced. According to Pimentel, some damage is even caused by the state itself, as the geoglyphs were once used as targets for Air Force practices. Moreover, seven editions of the Dakar Rally, an annual off-road motor racing event held in challenging terrains around the world, have damaged a total of 318 archaeological sites in the Atacama Desert, according to the National Monuments Council, a government agency in Chile. Specialists agree that it is not feasible to install surveillance cameras at every site or to fence off every geoglyph to prevent vehicle circulation. Instead, they emphasize the need to address complaints, enforce sanctions, revise the National Monuments Law, and require greater control from tourism and mining companies. Fundamentally, they call for the state to collaborate on educational initiatives to ensure that the public is cognizant about the sites. With these relics of the Atacama Desert facing an uncertain future, the chance to study their role in pre-Columbian culture has, in some ways, begun to fade. The race to save them from further harm is in desperate need of momentum. The majority of Atacama's geoglyphs lie between Arica and Antofagasta, two Chilean cities separated by approximately 435 miles. Some of these works, like the Atacama Giant or the Giant of Tarapacá, a 390-foot-long anthropomorphic figure, are well-known and equipped with signage and surveillance cameras, which have, in some cases, allowed authorities to find vehicle owners. Chilean law states that anyone who damages archaeological sites can face more than 5 years in prison and fines exceeding $14,500. However, it is difficult to prove that a person caused damage without catching them in the act, an almost impossible task given the vastness of the desert, and evidence must be presented that they acted intentionally. It is incomprehensible that that people claim they don't know or that there are no signs. There's a profound lack of awareness regarding the unique and exceptional nature of this ancient cultural expression, Sepulveda says. Marking ancient caravan routes from the Pacific coast to the Andean highlands, the geoglyphs once served as a guide through the desert. They indicated, for instance, the locations of waterholes, ravines, or road forks. But they weren't mere traffic signs, clarifies Daniela Valenzuela, director of the doctoral program in anthropology at the University of Tarapacá. The geoglyphs are also thought to have marked ceremonial or religious sites. The Giant of Tarapacá, for example, may represent a deity, a shaman, or a yatiri, a spiritual leader and healer of the Aymara people, an indigenous culture in the Altiplano region of South America, which lies in the central Andes Mountains. Created using different techniques, Atacama's geoglyphs depict various motifs depending on the region. In Arica, the additive method, in which stones were placed to form the figures, predominates, and there are more representations of llamas. In Tarapacá, however, the extractive technique is more common, resulting in carved out geometric shapes like circles, Andean crosses, a symbol found throughout the Andes, and arrows. Pimentel points out that the creators of these geoglyphs drew human figures according to their own identities, with specific details of their own clothing. These were formal systems for recording the history of their people, he explains. Some geoglyphs, for instance, feature figures from the colonial era that record the European invasion of the region. If you wanted to learn the history of those times, you went out to the trails to see images. The threat to geoglyphs extends even beyond Chile and the Atacama Desert. Thousands of structures are left defenseless throughout the Amazon rainforest as tracts of forested land are whittled away for cattle farming and cash crop production. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.